Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Wednesday, September 23rd, 2020. I'm your reader, Alan Fredergill, substituting today for your usual Wednesday reader, Ike Rayford. Ike is out helping to certify Sioux City police officer candidates today, but he'll be back, as usual, next week. Here's a look at what I'll be reading today. First, I'll take a look at the weather, then the mini editorial, then front page and inside stories of local interest. About 20 minutes after the hour, I'll read letters to the editor and editorials. Then at about 30 minutes past the hour, I'll read the obituaries. After that, it will be feature stories, sports, and other stories as time allows. First, here's the weather, then the mini editorial. Going to be very warm today with a blend of sun and clouds. Partly patchy clouds tonight, however. Clearing in the southwest, northwest Iowa. Mostly sunny tomorrow, mostly sunny and very warm, and there will be some wind coming out of the southeast, 8 to 16 miles an hour today, 59 for your low Wednesday night, and Thursday will be 82, Friday 89, Saturday 81, and Sunday 79. Still no rain in this forecast, and it's going to be mostly sunny, but there'll be some clouds along the way. Well, here's the mini editorial today. This comes from Douglas Vandervoort of Sioux City. The writer of the September 16th mini editorial criticizes the city washing streets after a, quote, week of rain, close quote. A rain that spread in a half inch of water evenly over that time and at no time required the use of an umbrella barely wets the streets and certainly does not wash them. One of the first stories this morning from the front page of the Journal is that the Lamb Theater is presenting a play online as well as live 6 months later than intended. On a darkened stage at Lamb Arts Regional Theater, director Diana Woolley led a cast of four actors in a production of Outside Mullingar, a story of passion, eccentricity, and star-crossed lovers living on a farm in Ireland through a rehearsal. This production of John Patrick Shanley's Tony Award-nominated play was meant to be performed back in March, Woolley said, but it was delayed when her husband and Outside Mullingar cast member Russ Woolley sprained his ankle. Shortly after that, COVID-19 concerns caused Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds to declare a statewide public health disaster emergency that forced Lamb and other theaters to immediately shut down for the season. Now, with heightened protocol in place to protect actors, the theater crew, and audience members, Outside Mullingar can go on again, more than 6 months behind schedule. In some ways, this is the perfect play for the times, Woolley said with a wry smile. We could all use a good old-fashioned romance right now. However, the way this production is being performed is anything but old-fashioned. The curtain for Outside Mullingar will rise with 7:30 p.m. shows on Thursday through Saturday, October 1st through the 3rd, as well as 1:30 p.m. matinees on Sunday and on October 4th. Audience size will be limited to about 25% capacity at the 417 Market Street Theater, and all attendees must wear a mask or face covering. In addition, a streaming version of Lamb's production of Outside Mullingar will be available at lambtheater.com. A few days prior to its September 18th premiere, Woolley was keeping her fingers crossed. We can be playing this show for an audience of 20 people or an audience of 2 people, Woolley said with a sigh. Nobody knows. Russ Woolley is just happy in the knowledge that the professional theater that he and his wife founded will actually have a 41st season. Many theater groups, especially ones that are larger than ours, aren't able to open, Russ Woolley said. We're one of the lucky ones. Even so, Lamb's season will be greatly truncated. After Outside Mullingar, Lamb will be presenting An Act of God from November 20th to December 6th, Bakersfield Mist from March 5th to 21st, 2021, and Beer for Breakfast from May 7th to the 23rd of 2021. Each of the plays has a cast of 2 or 3 actors, and all should be very modest productions, Russ Woolley explained. I had to tear up and rewrite this season's schedule 3 times already. I think we've come to a solution. Think small and hope for the best. That is why seating in Lamb's main theater has been reduced, and performances in their small The Box venue are being discontinued until a future date. Diana Woolley is also taking no chances when it comes to something other people may overlook. After each rehearsal or performance, I wash and disinfect every prop that is physically handled, she said. Even if it is as small as a coffee mug, the prop will be personally washed by me, the director. Such measures are needed to keep everyone safe. We owe it to the theater-going community who've been supportive of us over the years, Woolley said. Indeed, the couple said friends and patrons have been waiting for the return of live theater. I could be in line at Hy-Vee, and people would ask, when will Lamb Theater open again? Russ Woolley said. It feels good that they've missed us. Bet we've missed them just as much, his wife said. Maybe more. Bunch of photographs with this article I'll tell you about in a minute. But working with lighting director Rick Goble and some last-minute changes, Diana Woolley admitted putting on a play in the middle of a pandemic has been challenging. We're working with the left side of our brains as well as the right side, she said. We want to entertain, but we want to do it safely. Moving from a farm kitchen set situated stage left to a barn set that is in the middle, Woolley directed Goble to change the direction of an overhead light. Show must go on, she insisted. Nothing can stop outside Mullingar, not even COVID-19. Now back to those photos. The one I'm looking at shows Lamb Theater's Diana Woolley as she listens to lighting designer Rick Goble when he talks about lighting a stage for both live viewers as well as for the video on the set of the theater's production of Outside Mullingar. And then several other photographs show Lamb Theater's Diana Woolley as she carries a bowl of flowers onto the set of the theater's production of Outside Mullingar. And then another one yet shows Russ Woolley and Diana as they talk about the challenges and opportunities of staging a theater production during the COVID-19 pandemic. They appear to be standing in the lobby of their theater. Go to Outside Mullingar. It's a romantic comedy by John Patrick Shanley, and the shows start at 7:30 p.m. Thursday through Saturday, October 1st through 3rd, as well as 1:30 p.m. matinees on Sunday, as well as October 4th. It's at Lamb Arts Regional Theater, 417 Market Street in Sioux City. Audience and Lamb staff will be required to wear a mask inside the theater. Seating will be limited to 1/3 capacity, and social distancing will be enforced. There are other options. A streamed version of Lamb's production of Outside Mullingar will be available for viewing at lambtheater.com. The next story from the first page of the Journal this morning is that 6 weeks to election, Scholten and Feenstra are aiming for the finish line in Iowa's 4th District. 6 weeks from now, the outcome of the 4th Congressional District of Iowa contest will be revealed, with November 3rd voting determining whether Randy Feenstra will seize the win and continue the Republican Party hold on the seat, or if J.D. Scholten pulls off the upset that narrowly eluded him in 2018. At this point 2 years ago, campaign donations were flowing in large fashion to Scholten. A lot of people were motivated down the stretch to oust incumbent U.S. Representative Steve King from Chiron after a flurry of questions about his support for far-right political parties and candidates. Scholten is again the Democratic nominee in the 4th District, but King is out of the race, following his defeat by nearly 10% to Feenstra in a June primary election. Feenstra got a congratulatory phone call from President Donald Trump. That primary win immediately moved many political prognosticators to predict a solid Feenstra victory in the fall. An Iowa poll by the Des Moines Register over the weekend put Feenstra's lead at only 5 percentage points, and for comparison, Scholten's narrow loss to King was by 3 points. A lot of people wrote us off early in the summer. We just put our head down, said Scholten, who is bullish on his chances over the next 42 days. We're right where we need to be. Our internal poll showed we are doing even better than what the Des Moines Register poll showed, he said. Scholten said he believes he can win because this district has a lot of independent thinkers. There are more independents than Democrats, as voting registration in the 4th District in September shows 203,000 Republicans, 128,000 Democrats, and 153,000 no party, making for a big advantage for Feenstra. Feenstra said being a Republican in the 4th District is certainly an advantage, but he isn't taking that for granted. We're trying to motivate the base, he says. We're playing like we're 10 points behind. Feenstra pointed to a Monmouth University Polling Institute measure, which in early August released a poll showing him with a 20-point lead. King had never lost a race in his 24-year political career until Feenstra, an Iowa state senator from Hull, won in the 5-candidate primary. In a journal interview on Friday, King said he would not endorse Feenstra, saying it was best not to comment on his campaign. Said Feenstra, "I would appreciate it if he would endorse me. I guess it's up to him. We just want all the Republicans marching in the same direction." Earlier this year, spread of the novel coronavirus resulted in a halt to in-person campaigning, but some of that has resumed in recent weeks. Scholten has been holding parking lot rallies where he stands in a flatbed truck. His comments are broadcast via radio frequency to people parked at the event, and they can send text messages to pose questions. That's part of his swing to visit all 374 towns in the 39 counties which comprise the 4th District. And after one Tuesday in Jefferson, Iowa, Scholten said that quest will be done by early October. Scholten said key issues he's seeing connect with the pandemic, as people are worried about maintaining health insurance and hearing Republican plans to reduce Medicare and Medicaid programs. He also said farmers are uneasy after 7 years of low commodity prices and tariffs that Trump put in place. Feenstra spoke after touring a biodiesel plant in Wall Lake, Iowa. He said he's visiting businesses using social distancing precautions and wearing masks. Some of the monthly county Republican Party organizations have resumed meetings in person, while many still only do them via video conferencing. Feenstra said top issues are boosting agricultural opportunities and the prospects of small businesses, some of which have not reopened since the coronavirus brunt hit. He said it is imperative that pro-life policies are pursued. "People are looking for somebody who can deliver or be a voice for them," Feenstra claimed. "It is currently uncertain whether an opportunity for Iowans to see the two men hash over issues side by side. As of now, there are no set debates." Scholten said his approach is anytime, any place, and that a debate is needed, since people know Feenstra far less than they do King after his 18 years in office. For his part, Feenstra said there are some October media debate options, and he may agree to some. "We're looking at other arrangements," he said. There won't be a release of campaign fundraising until mid-October for a quarterly summary of months of July through September. This year, Scholten has led all Iowa 4th congressional district candidates in fundraising, such as when he raised $618,000 for the second quarter through the month of June. Feenstra brought in only $403,000 over that same time. Combined over the 2020 cycle, Scholten has raised $1.65 million, while Feenstra has had only $1.25 million in contributions. Scholten said his third quarter fundraising number will surpass that of the second quarter, and said people who believe his 2020 funding will pale compared to his 2018 are misguided. A December 2018 fundraising report showed Scholten raised more than $1.5 million from October 19th to November 26th, just before and after Election Day in his showdown with King. Feenstra said Scholten may not nab the top amount of fundraising on the 2018 final stretch, since the dynamics have changed significantly over the last 2 years. As for his fundraising, Feenstra said, "We are looking at a very strong quarter again. We're trying to get as much in-state money as possible." The final story from the front page of the Journal this morning is that Iowa health officials are investigating the cause of the surge in Sioux Land counties of the COVID-19 virus. Health officials in Iowa are working to determine what is causing a spike in coronavirus cases in the northwest corner of the state, where several counties are seeing a surge, Governor Kim Reynolds said Tuesday. Sioux County has a 14-day positivity rate of 30%. Public health officials usually recommend mitigation measures, including crowd restrictions, face coverings, and business closures to slow the virus spread when an area surpasses 5% positivity. Two adjacent counties, Lyon and Osceola, have rates above 20%. In Sioux County, there isn't a specific outbreak, so we need to continue doing the case investigation. I think that it's saying that there is significant community spread happening within the county, and then they need to do what they can to help mitigate that, Reynolds said, while still not ordering a mask mandate, which is shown to reduce the spread. The Republican governor acknowledged that the rate of spread is very high, but claimed she's hopeful it's stabilizing. She's sending thoughts and prayers. The county began seeing cases increase in early August and has seen the 14-day rolling total of positive cases increase sixfold, as none of the people in those counties seem to want to wear masks. I don't know what's going on up there, Reynolds said. It's what we see a lot of times when we start to open things up, and I think we should expect that you're going to see probably a little uptake in cases. Sixfold is not a little uptake. The White House Coronavirus Task Force had been advising Iowa to implement a mask policy for weeks, but Reynolds continued to refuse, even as the state surged to the top of all states for virus spread in August. I'll read that again. The state has surged to the top spot of all states for virus spread in August. Reynolds has resisted for no apparent logical reason. She did close bars in six counties for a short time when increases were noticed in highly populated areas and in university towns. In the past weeks, the overall state situation has improved, but daily statistics remain elevated. Iowa's positive case numbers surpassed 81,000 on Tuesday as the state posted 517 new cases in the past 24 hours, including 19 deaths, raising our death toll in Iowa to 1,285 citizens who have succumbed to the virus. It's obvious that people are not wearing masks in northwest Iowa, said David Johnson, a retired state senator who lives in Ocheyedan in Osceola County. He said funerals and weddings are packed with people not wearing masks or practicing social distancing. In his city, typically only those working in businesses where masks are required, such as a clinic or pharmacy, wear them, he said. That may explain the uptake in cases, but Reynolds continued to play politics as she met Tuesday with U.S. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson, who was in Des Moines to discuss federal housing programs for low-income elderly residents, by the way, who are dying at a high rate. Carson is a retired neurosurgeon and said he has confidence in the system of rigorous vaccine testing, but that it takes time to go through all the appropriate steps to ensure it's effective and safe, and that people should be patient. It is true that with viral infections of this type, they do have a natural course, and you know, given a long enough period of time, it would on its own go away, but obviously we don't want to wait that long, he said. Once approved, he said people shouldn't worry about whether it's safe to take the vaccine, and he offered his advice to those who oppose taking a vaccine. I would say, would you rather continue with COVID-19 controlling your life, or would you like to get to the other side of this and move on? Carson said. Moving now to the opinion page, it's no surprise that the Journal wants the Supreme Court vacancy from Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death to be filled. As they say, seemingly endless cycle of power politics will continue. We believe President Donald Trump should nominate someone to fill the seat of late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and the nomination should get an up or down vote by the full Senate. No need exists for Trump or the Senate to wait for the November 3rd election, because it's the president's right under the Constitution to fill high court vacancies and the Senate's duty to take up nominations. We also believed, and we said so in this space at the time, The same was true of President Obama following the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. In 2016, 8 months from the presidential election, Obama nominated Merrick Garland, but majority Senate Republicans led by Mitch McConnell refused to consider the nomination. Why? Because Chuck Grassley, they said, voters in the next election should decide who gets to fill the seat. This time, less than 2 months before the election for president, no such demand was made by the majority Senate Republicans, still led by McConnell. Instead, McConnell vowed Trump's nominee for a replacement will receive a vote on the Senate floor, and Chuck Grassley approves. As we said in our March 23, 2016 editorial, we believe the Senate should have performed its advice and consent responsibility by giving Garland a full, fair vetting. In the end, individual senators should have explained to Americans why they supported or opposed him. In other words, senators should have done their jobs. In our minds, the same holds true today. That's a consistent position. Of course, the spectacle unfolding in the wake of Ginsburg's death on Friday isn't consistent with what happened in 2016, but it isn't surprising either. Hypocrisy is never in short supply within the Republican Party in our nation's capital. If, for example, a Republican occupied the White House when a liberal justice of a split Supreme Court died in a presidential election year in which Democrats controlled the Senate, would the Senate of today hold hearings on a nominee chosen by the president? If, in another example, a Democrat president who enjoyed Democratic control of the Senate wanted to replace a Supreme Court justice less than 7 weeks before a presidential election, would Republicans like McConnell today react with anything less than furious indignation? The answer to both questions is, we believe, no. So even though in our view it's proper for them to give Trump's choice due consideration this year, in fact, Senate Republicans didn't do the same for Obama's choice 4 years ago, will add fuel to the fire of payback. And what is seemingly an endless cycle of power politics will continue to what we believe is the detriment of our country. And now letters to the editor. And the first one comes from Matthew Ung from Sioux City. He says, why can't we use the science we do have for today? After every major fire in the West, smart people write opinion columns and create academic studies. They commonly recommend that we respect nature's circle of life by not being so aggressive in suppressing fire every time we see and conducting more controlled burns around populated areas. For the last several decades, as evidenced by the numbers, our collective response has been to say no. There may exist a fanciful notion that the more old trees we pack into a valley, the more we love science. These articles, which you can easily find in a Google search, are written by both conservative and liberal publications. The common goal is to avoid creating forest powder kegs that explode into cataclysmic blazes when they do burn, and that end up fueling much more pollution compared to controlled burns. And every time the radical environmentalists, in his words, in charge, say no to the science that could help today, instead appear $1 trillion 100-year plans to right climate change. Then they say anyone who doesn't agree with their $1 trillion 100-year plans are rejecting science. Why can't we use the science we have today? It comes from right-wing Matthew Ung of Sioux City. Next letter is from Bruce Lear, Sioux City, who says, Steve Hansen is a proven leader. Help me welcome Steve Hansen back to running for political office after an 18-year hiatus. Steve is running to represent Iowa House District 14 on Sioux City's west side. While away from politics, Steve directed the Sioux City Museum and built it into an Iowa destination. Steve Hansen is committed to listening to the people of Sioux City and fighting to ensure a solid economy, world-class public education system, and affordable, accessible health care plans. He will work tirelessly to maintain and enhance the quality of life in Siouxland. Please join me in voting for Steve Hansen, a proven leader. Turning now to page A3 of the journal, we see that Woodburn and Crawford counties record COVID-19 deaths yesterday. Two Northwest Iowa counties recorded COVID-19-related deaths on Tuesday. Sioux Land District Health Department reported that two Woodbury County residents, a woman in the 41 to 60 age range and a man in the 61 to 80 age range, succumbed to the novel coronavirus. The county's death toll now stands at 63. Crawford County recorded one additional COVID-19-related death, bringing its tally to 5. According to Iowa Department of Public Health data, Woodbury County had 5,052 total cases of the virus as of Tuesday evening, while Crawford had 1,016. Sioux County's 14-day positivity rate of 30.2% continued to lead the state, followed by Osceola at 24.1%, Crawford at 22.4%, Lyon at 21.9%, Plymouth at 18.6%, and Sac at 18.2%. Ida County's rate of 17.6% ranked 8th highest, followed by Woodbury County in 10th place at 15.1%. Eric Hoekstra, president of Dort University, said in a statement that the Sioux Center College had seen an increase in COVID-19 cases in its student body. As of Monday, the college had 8 active positive COVID-19 cases among its students. 63 students were in quarantine or in isolation. This is discouraging news since we saw a decrease in COVID-19 cases in our student body in mid-September, Hoekstra said. Dort will remain at the yellow alert level, but will heighten precautions, such as limiting event attendance, according to the statement. The rec center, campus store, and Holst Library will remain closed to the public. Morningside College is moving to operating level orange, effective Wednesday. All face-to-face classes will be required to be taught in a hybrid format that allows for adequate physical distancing within each classroom at Morningside. Enhanced enforcement of occupancy requirements will be implemented in residence halls, and seating in the car will be further reduced to ensure more physical distancing. We will remain in orange until further notice. Our hope is that numbers will stabilize and begin trending downward so that we can return to yellow at some point in the coming weeks, said John Reinders, the Sioux City College's president. Morningside College reported 46 new student cases and 2 new faculty staff cases for the week ending September 20th. School district at Marcus Meriden Cleghorn announced that it will extend its hybrid learning model through September 25th due to its high number of COVID-19 cases at the high school. Marcus Meriden Cleghorn Remsen Union, which has students in Plymouth and Cherokee County, switched to hybrid learning on September 3rd. We feel that extending the hybrid learning model for our high school students will help us to better limit contact tracing and quarantine, and also help keep more of our students eligible for activities, Superintendent Dan Barkle wrote in a letter addressed to the MMCRU community. State statistics, which were last updated Tuesday, show that a total of 446 hospital beds are available in this region. The same region has 13 COVID-19 patients in ICU beds, and there are still 84 beds available. The state statistics show 9 ventilators are being used by patients in this area, but an additional 68 are available for the program. Further news from Sioux City will come after we read the obituary. And you are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Wednesday, September 23rd, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Unfortunately, we have quite a few. The first one comes from Dakota City, Amy C. Barbie. Amy Colleen Barbie, 42, of Dakota City, passed away Friday, September 11th, of natural causes at her residence. A celebration of her life will be held noon to 4 p.m. Sunday at Riverside Park at shelter number 5. All family and friends are welcome. We will be having a potluck, one of Amy's favorite things to do. Arrangements are under the direction of Waterbury Funeral Service. Amy, the daughter of Carol M. Lee, was born on August 14, 1978 in Council Bluffs. She grew up in Sioux City and attended public schools here to complete the 11th grade. She then met Brandon Barbie and they married on July 23, 1998. They had been together for 25 years. They were the love of each other's lives. of this union, they had two beautiful daughters, Brittany and Chelsea. Amy worked at many jobs, most recent being at Divi and Inception Outdoors, working side by side with Brandon. Amy was proud of her family and loved them so much. She was extremely excited when she became a grandma Nana with her first grandbaby, Xander. Then came Axel, then Uriah, and another on the way, which she was so looking forward to holding. She was a good mom to Brittany and Chelsea, who have many good memories of their mom. Amy loved playing with the grandbabies. She was a great person and had a big heart, always willing to help anyone in need. If you needed a ride, you could call Amy and she would be there. Amy loved the outdoors, camping, and fishing with Brandon and the girls, family, and friends, and her fur babies. Her most favorite place was Ponca State Park. She loved family get-togethers at the park for picnics and cookouts, or just going to someone's house for a barbecue. We will miss Amy's presence. Please direct memorials to Amy's family. From Sergeant Bluff, Jolene K. Tonner, 84, died Monday, September 21st. Waterbury Funeral Service of Sergeant Bluff is in charge. From Sioux City, Craig F. Herbold, 72, died Thursday, September 17th. Waterbury Funeral Service of Sergeant Bluff is in charge. From Sioux City, Michael L. Foister, 40, died Sunday, September 20th. Waterbury Funeral Service of Sergeant Bluff is in charge. From Quimby, Iowa, Coraline June Walter, 78, died Thursday, March 26th. Memorial services are being held September 26th at 10:30 a.m. at the Quimby United Methodist Church. Visitation is September 25th from 4 to 7 at the Boothby Funeral Home in Cherokee. From Cherokee, Dale L. Klein, 86, died September 11th. Services are September 25th at 10:30 a.m. at Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Cherokee. Burial is in Oak Hill Cemetery. Visitation is tomorrow, September 24th, from 3 to 7 p.m. at the Boothby Funeral Home in Cherokee. And from Sioux City, Keith McCudden, Ronald Keith McCudden, 89, of Sioux City, went to be with his Lord on Monday, September 21st, with his family by his side. Services will be 1:30 p.m. today at Wesley United Methodist Church with the Reverend Todd Schlitter and Reverend Lawrence Strafler officiating. Masonic services will be given by Triangle Lodge, and military honors will be held at the church by the U.S. Naval Reserve. Visitation with the family will begin at 12:30 p.m. today at the church. Arrangements are under the direction of Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel, and online condolences can be left on the Meyer Brothers website. Keith was born on June 21, 1931, to Kent and Grace Blatt McCudden. He was the older brother to Gary and Mick. He went to school in Leeds. He served in the U.S. Navy for 4 years and the reserves for 4 years. On September 8, 1962, he married the love of his life, Elaine Ewald. They had two boys, Russ and Clint. In 1969, he started at Missouri Valley Steel, learning on the job to be a structural draftsman. He drafted the plans for the Theos building, helped on the project for the Skywalk system in downtown Sioux City, and helped with the Ho-Chunk building. Keith belonged to the Triangle Masonic Lodge as a master in 1968. He was active in Scottish Rite of Sioux City as Knight Commander of the Court of Honor. He was a longtime member of Wesley United Methodist Church and served in many activities and projects, including the SALT Monday Noon Meal. Keith enjoyed camping as a family, teaching adult Bible study, and reading books. He was well known for telling everyone, "I love you." Also from Sioux City, Gary McCudden, 86, of Sioux City, passed away Saturday, September 19th at a local hospital. Services will be 11 a.m. today at Wesley United Methodist Church with the Reverend Todd Schlitter and Reverend Lawrence Strafler officiating. Private family burial will be in Memorial Park Cemetery with military honors by the U.S. Naval Reserve. Visitation with the family will be 1 hour prior to the service on Monday, our service today. Arrangements are under the direction of Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel, and online condolences can be left on their website. Gary was born on November 1st, 1933, to Kent and Grace Blatt McCudden. He received his education at Leeds High School. Gary was homecoming king his senior year and graduated with the class in 1952. He served in the U.S. Navy for 4 years before receiving his honorable discharge. Gary married Donna Gilson on May 5, 1956, in Sioux City at Wesley United Methodist Church. His working career was spent rebuilding trucks in and around Sioux City. Gary enjoyed constantly learning and reading throughout his life. He was an amazing, fine woodworker. He found his greatest joy whenever his family was around, and he had a special bond with his brothers, Keith and Meg. His membership to Wesley United Methodist Church was a lifelong joy through baptism, confirmation, marriage, strengthening of his faith with his Lord, and today with his funeral service, an appropriate conclusion. Gary was preceded in death by his parents and his grandchild, Aaron Steve McCudden. From Marcus, Iowa, formerly of Sioux City, Sandra Gay Vint, V-I-N-T, 70, died Sunday, September 20th. A private family service will be held through the Ernest Johnson Funeral Home of Marcus, Iowa. From Pearson, Iowa, Joan R. Fuller, 92, died Tuesday, September 22nd. Rhody Funeral Home of Kingsley is in charge. And from Sioux City, Curtis Lee Parks, 47, died Friday, September 18th. A memorial service will be held September 26th at 11 a.m. at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. From Sioux City, Marilyn J. Millage, 82, of Sioux City, passed away Thursday, September 17th at a local hospital. Services will be 10:30 a.m. today at Modern Day Parish Immaculate Conception Church with the Reverend Rupp celebrant. Burial will be in Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation is 5 to 7 p.m., was 5 to 7 p.m. yesterday, or will be tomorrow, with a vigil service at 7 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Due to the ongoing pandemic, the family requests attendees to wear a mask to the visitation and service. Online condolences can be left on Meyer Brothers' website. Marilyn was born on November 21, 1937, in Sioux City, the daughter of Edward and Marion Ebmeyer McClure. She grew up in Sioux City and graduated from Bishop Heelan High School in 1955. Marilyn married Ronald Millage in Sioux City on June 18, 1960. They had five kids. Ronald preceded Marilyn in death by just 11 days. Marilyn earned her nursing degree from St. Joseph's School of Nursing in 1959. She went on to work as a nurse for 44 years at Mercy One Hospital, formerly known as both St. Joseph Hospital and Marion Health Center. Marion was very involved with her grandchildren. She attended many of their activities when they were younger. She enjoyed visiting Trinity Heights in Sioux City, where her nursing school photo is proudly displayed. Marilyn loved to travel. She would collect spoons from the various locations she would visit. Her favorite trip was to Europe, where she traveled with her husband. The couple would also travel around the country, having visited most of the states. Marilyn also collected dolls and Disney memorabilia. She was especially fond of Mickey Mouse. She loved the holidays, especially Christmas, when she would decorate the house inside and out with various decorations, including Disney, Iowa State Cyclones, and the Iowa Hawkeyes. And then Ronald Millage Sr. from Sioux City. Ronald Ray Millage, 81, of Sioux City, passed away Sunday, September 6th at a local hospital. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Friday at Modern Day Parish Immaculate Conception Church with the Reverend Rob Celebrant. Burial will be in Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday with a vigil service at 7 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Due to the ongoing pandemic, the family requests attendees to wear a mask to the visitation and the service. Online condolences can be left on Meyer Brothers' website. Ronald was born on August 17, 1939, in Sioux City, the son of Elmer and Mabel Yunt Millage. He grew up in Sioux City and graduated from Leeds High School in 1957. Ronald married Marilyn McCure in Sioux City on June 18, 1960. They had five kids that I mentioned in Marilyn's obituary. Ronald worked at a meatpacking plant in Sioux City. He then attended and graduated from the University of South Dakota. After graduation, he worked with special needs people for the state of Nebraska. He followed his passion of working out and lifting by opening a gym called the Rendering Plant in Sioux City. Ronald then worked for Mercy Medical Center as a security officer until his retirement. Ronald loved living in Sioux City and the Leeds neighborhood. He was passionate about his collection of Sioux City and Leeds memorabilia, which is currently on exhibit at the Sioux City Museum, dedicated to him and his wife, Marilyn. He was an avid fan of the Chicago Bears and Cubs and the Iowa Hawkeyes. He enjoyed lifting weights in his younger years, a passion that followed him throughout his life. He also enjoyed taking walks along the riverfront, collecting stamps, spending time in his yard, attending auctions, and meeting the boys for coffee at Hy-Vee. Continuing with obituaries, Lynn A. Ford of Mankato, Minnesota, but formerly from Sioux City, has died. Passed away peacefully in his home Saturday, September 12th, after a recently discovered and fast-moving health condition. A public celebration of Lynn's life will be 4 to 6 p.m. Monday at Northview North Mankato Mortuary, 2016 Commerce Drive in North Mankato. Burial will be in Fort Snelling National Cemetery at a later date. Due to space constraints, a private service will be held at Northview. For those wishing to watch from the comfort and safety of your own home, it will be available online by Tuesday evening at www.mankatomortuary.com, where you can also share your favorite memory of Lynn with his family. Because we want everyone who wishes to honor Lynn's life by participating in his visitation, and because we want everyone to stay safe, we request that you honor the following concerning COVID-19. If you answer yes to any of the following symptoms, we respectfully ask that you please refrain from attending the visitation and/or private service and burial. In the past 24 hours, have you had any of the following symptoms? Fever, cough not due to allergies, sore throat, shortness of breath, or loss of smell and taste? Have you traveled internationally in the last 14 days? Have you had close personal contact with anyone who has been diagnosed with COVID-19 in the past 14 days per the criteria below? Within 6 feet for prolonged periods, in direct contact with infectious secretions, been coughed, sneezed upon, etc.? Is your temperature equal to or higher than 100 degrees? Lynn was born in Sioux City on March 2, 1948, to Arthur T. Ford Jr. and Vina Fritz Ford. He graduated from Sioux City Central High School in 1966 and attended Western Iowa Tech Community College for a year and a half and Hayward and Junior College for one semester. In 1968, he joined the U.S. Air Force. He was stationed for 6 months in Guam, where he got to see the Bob Hope USO show in person and was videotaped in the audience, which he aired on TV. He spent the bulk of his enlistment stationed with the 28th Bomb Wing at Ellsworth Air Force Base in Rapid City, South Dakota. While still in the Air Force, he continued pursuing his college education, which he completed with both bachelor's and master's degree from Mankato State University. 7 months before his military discharge, Lynn met his future and beloved wife, Paulette Stogsdell, who had just started her teaching career in that Rapid City public school system. 3 months before his military discharge, Lynn worked as a volunteer for the Rapid City flood recovery in 1972, an experience that left an impact on him for the rest of his life. On July 14, 1973, Lynn married his sweetheart, Paulette, and 3.5 years later, they were blessed with their one and only child, Adam, their absolute pride and joy. Career-wise, Lynn spent 29 years working for the Minnesota Regional Treatment Center in St. Peter, Minnesota. He first worked as a security guard slash counselor for the criminally insane, then for 7 years as a social worker on the sex offender unit. Lastly, as a psychologist for the mentally ill and dangerous. It's quite a resume. Lynn was an avid sports fan, playing fast pitch amateur baseball while in the service and spending his honeymoon with Paulette in right field at Met Stadium, competing with 6 and 7 year olds, catching fly balls during the Twins practice before settling down to watch the games. He also played fast pitch softball in the 1980s. Their season tickets took Lynn and Paulette to many enjoyable Vikings football games. Equal to his love of ball games was Lynn's passion for motorcycles and motorcycling all over the country, from Sacramento, California to Washington, D.C., Colorado, Black Hills, and just countless other motorcycle trips. He started out on a 1971 500 Kawasaki, which held the quarter-mile speed record at that time, and ended up with a 2002 1800 Illusion Blue Goldwing, which he later tricked out. As time went by, Lynn started traveling with RVs, motorhomes, making trips to Glacier National Park in Montana, across North Dakota to its beautiful Badlands, and through the scenic beauty of Colorado and the Black Hills of South Dakota. After retirement, golfing became Lynn's steady job, which lasted for years. When health issues put the kibosh on both motorcycling and golfing, Lynn became a pool shark at Vine, where he gave his pool playing buddies a run for their money, which he would say wasn't saying much since no money was involved. Known for his dry wit and somewhat sarcastic sense of humor, Lynn's one-liners could crack people up, even the hospice workers, a gift he gave us all during the last 3 weeks of life, making the heaviness of his impending death so much lighter. One of his favorite quotes was, If I haven't offended you yet with my sarcasm, please be patient. In lieu of flowers, feel free to donate to the Mankato Mayo Clinic Hospice, MCHS, 1025 Marsh Street, Mankato, Minnesota, 56001. Unfortunately, still quite a few more obituaries this morning. The next is from Sioux City. Julie Ebel, 44, died Saturday, September 19th. A drive-in celebration of life will be held September 24th at First Lutheran Church in the parking lot in Milford, Iowa. Burial will be in Pleasant View Cemetery in Hartley, Iowa. Hartley Funeral Home is in charge. And from Sioux City, Clark J. Godfrey, 86, died Friday, September 18th at Doherty Hospice House in Sioux Falls. Visitation will be 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Friday at Morningside Chapel, Christy Smith Funeral Home, 1801 Morningside Avenue. The family requests that visitors dress casually, wear a mask, and social distance as much as possible. A private graveside service will be in the Memorial Park Cemetery. Clark J. Godfrey, the son of Leonard and Azela Godfrey, was born on September 12, 1934, in Sioux City. He graduated from East High School in 1952. After high school, Clark went on into construction with his brothers and later worked at Cudahy's meatpacking plant. He spent most of his career at the Sioux City Journal, retiring after 37 years in advertising in 1997. On June 24, 1960, Clark was united in marriage with Mary Talsma at Grace United Methodist Church in Sioux City. They were married for 55 years. Mary died July 6, 2015. Clark also played fast pitch softball as a young man. Later in life, he coached Little League, Youth League, and American League Baseball. Clark was an avid fan of the Los Angeles Dodgers, the Iowa Hawkeyes, and the Iowa State Cyclones. He enjoyed golf, working in the yard, and watching his kids and grandkids play sports. From South Sioux City, Twyla F. Patak, PTAK 83 of South Sioux City, died Thursday, September 17th at her residence. Services will be 11 a.m. Saturday at Warren Becker Hunt Funeral Home in South Sioux City with the Reverend Paul Milkinson of Light of the World officiating. Burial will be in Garden of the Memories Cemetery in Yankton. Visitation with the family will be 1 hour prior to service at the funeral home. Online condolences may be left on the Meyer Brothers website. Twyla was born on January 15th, 1970. 37 at her country home in New Mexico to Arthur D. and Alma Brigance Garrison. She went through the fourth grade in country school before the family moved to Mount Dare, New Mexico, where she graduated from Mountain Air High School. Twyla married the love of her life, Leslie F. Patak, at age 18 in her parents' home on December 24, 1954. Following the marriage, the couple moved to Taber, South Dakota, where they lived before moving to Yankton in 1967. Then they moved to South Sioux City. From Sioux City, Elizabeth A. Treiber, T-R-E-B-I-B-E-R, 40, died Tuesday, May 12th. Services are May 26th at Immaculate Conception Church, and burials in Calvary Cemetery. From Allen, Nebraska, Galen B. Jackson, 92, of Allen, passed away Saturday, September 19th at Regency Square Center in South Sioux. Services will be 2 p.m. today at Allen United Methodist Church and will be live streamed. Arrangements are under the direction of Hazelman Funeral Home of Wayne, Nebraska. Galen B. Jackson was born October 16, 1927, on a farm west of Allen, Nebraska, to Ben and Inez Emery Jackson. He attended country school through the eighth grade and graduated from Allen High School with honors in 1944. Galen married his high school sweetheart, Carol Geiger, on March 1, 1947, at First Lutheran Church in Allen. He began farming with horses and milking cows on the family farm west of Allen. From Sioux City, Larry D. Cook, 51, of Sioux City, passed away Saturday, September 19th at a local hospital. Memorial services will be 2 p.m. Friday at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Visitation is 1 hour prior to the service. Larry was born on March 1, 1969 in Omaha to Lawrence and Vicki Thompson Cook. He grew up in the Omaha Council Bluffs area before moving to Sioux City permanently in 2014. He married Elizabeth Roberts on September 7, 2010 in Dakota City. Larry is a family man and a truly loving father and husband. He enjoyed playing catch and football with his friends and family. Always loved cheering on the Pittsburgh Steelers. And from April 10th of this year, from Hinton, Don Molstad, 71, died on April 20th. Memorial services are September 25th at 11 a.m. at Holy Cross St. Michael Catholic Church, Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel's in charge. From Sioux City, Dale Walsh, 83, of Sioux City, passed away Saturday, September 19th. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Thursday at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church with the Reverend David Heeman officiating. Burial will be in the Calvary Cemetery. Visitation will be 4 to 8 p.m. today, with the family present 5 to 8 p.m. and a vigil service at 7 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Dale was born February 20, 1937, on a family farm near Kimball, South Dakota, the son of Philip and Frances Blasius Walsh. Dale graduated from Kimball High School and the University of South Dakota. He enlisted in the U.S. Army Reserve and was discharged with an honorable discharge on December 31, 1966. He married Patricia Filmer on August 10, 1963, at the Cathedral of the Epiphany in Sioux City. He worked as a salesman for Vitacraft and then at MCI for a number of years before starting his own business, the Walsh Upholstery Shop. Dale worked up until Parkinson's made it too difficult. He enjoyed camping, being with his family, watching sports, and being a member of Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church. From Sioux City, Betty L. Huschen, H-U-E-S-C-H-E-N, 72, died Saturday, September 19th. Services are September 24th, 10:30. St. Paul Lutheran Church, burial in Memorial Park Cemetery with military rites. Visitation September 24th at 9:30 at the church. And finally, LaVon E. Hoops from Galva, 94, died Friday, September 18th. Services are September 26th at 2:30 at St. John's Lutheran Church in Galva. Holstein Cemetery will be the burial. Visitation is September 26th, 1:30 p.m. at the church. Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Holstein is in charge. Well, that does it for the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Wednesday, September 23rd, 2020. I've been your reader, Alan Frederick-Gill, subbing today for Ike Rayford, who will be back next Wednesday. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time, and thanks for listening.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay! Alrighty.
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing, it really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.